Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As you can see, there was such a big audience last night, and the fame of Bob Mundell's lecturing spread like wildfire. So, of course, we had to get a bigger hall tonight to accommodate what is undoubtedly an even bigger audience and more enthusiastic, or as enthusiastic as last night. I just want to, introducing this as a member of the Robbins family, I just want to say how much I cherish the connection which I formed with Bob through the Claremont seminars. He did allude briefly to these last night, but this was an incredible series of seminars which still goes on, organized by Randall Hinshaw of Claremont, who sadly died 2 years ago, and where Lionel Robbins used to be the moderator and run the discussions. And now I think the mantle of both Randall Hinshaw and Lionel Robbins has fallen on Bob, because he both organizes the Claremont seminars and acts as moderator and indeed the Robbins lecturer there at the last one. And these seminars are remarkable for the free discussion of international monetary issues and for the number of Nobel Prize winners who come. So now we have not just six who nearly all come each time, we shall have a seventh one, and somehow Nobel Prize winners are very hard to persuade them to go anywhere. They tend to rest on their laurels, but if they have the prospect of having a really savage argument with other Nobel Prize winners, they'll go halfway around the world. It's a remarkable phenomenon which I've observed. Now, before bringing Bob on to lecture, I just want to read out a piece of a highly complimentary article about him, which I gather he never saw, by Paul Fabre, who is undoubtedly the leading French economic commentator, writing in Les Echos on the occasion of Bob's Nobel Prize. Now, the heading of the article was, "What is an eccentric economist?" Well, no prizes for guessing the answer. It was clearly going to be Bob Mundell. But Paul reveals one or two personal details which I'll vouchsafe to you about Bob, as he did last night to you about Lionel Robbins. Bob Mundell spends several months a year in an old half-ruined Tuscan palace bought for a song 30 or 40 years ago. Aren't we all envious? On the only habitable floor, he runs a studious seminar every other year with colleagues invited from all over the world. Now, I gather one of the great things about winning a Nobel Prize is you can pay your builder's bills and actually do up your house. He's not the only one who sometimes wears his hair long or smokes a pipe. His striking originality runs deeper than that. As the Economist of the 16th of October put it, "European monetary union is a fact of life. Mr. Mundell was sure that it would happen, which was very eccentric on his part, but he was right." And then, in a wonderful French phrase, which I hesitate even to try and translate, he concludes, "Mundell, the modernist, thinks about the present historically. That is why he often manages to discover the future." Well, I think that's a great tribute and highly appropriate. But Bob is now going to discover another bit of the past, which we more or less lost track of or didn't understand, and that is what happened after the gold standard under the era of Bretton Woods from the mid-30s to the mid-50s. So Bob, you have the floor. Remember to turn your mic on.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Richard. I mentioned, let me see if I can get this. I mentioned last night that 35 years ago, I gave three lectures at the London School of Economics here that Lionel Robbins introduced me for. And the third night, people told me that not many people would come because competing at the same time, I think this was February the 12th, 1965, Malcolm X was speaking in the at the LSE, and everybody would go to that. So I was very gratified when more people came on that last night than others than previous nights. But a little bit sorry later, because it was very within a week after that Malcolm was killed. So today I'm going to talk on this. What I talked about before was my lectures are on the 20th century, which I conveniently divided up into three parts. And it is curious that it fits so nicely, the three parts. The first third of the century, up to 1930, covered the gold standard, the instability, the restoration of it, and the Great Depression. 1933 was the period when you could think that the international monetary system that was restored in the 1920s broke down, because that 1933, March 1933, was when President Roosevelt took the dollar off gold. And the dollar had become, over this period, the important, most important currency in the world. The U.S. Economy was four times, by 1933, four or five times larger than any alternative economy. And it was the dollar had become the unit of account in the world. Now, I discussed this this issue, and I'm not going to spend much time on it to repeat what I said. It was simply that World War I made gold unstable. Gold left Europe, it came to the United States, it raised the price level. The newly created Federal Reserve System allowed that gold to increase the price level. After the war, the price level had come down again, but it was still 40% above the 1914 price level. And that would have been an okay equilibrium if the rest of the world stayed off gold. But when in the 1920s, Germany, Britain, and France went back onto gold, it created new demands for gold, a scarcity of gold, and gold appreciated, which is another way of saying the price level came down. That was the Great Depression, and it was the it caused the stock market crash, it caused the falling price of raw materials, and it caused the great deflation of the 1930s, so that with the figures that I presented last time, the price level in 1933 was the same as the price level in 1914. The gold standard, by going back to gold, it did what its job was, which is to keep the world stable in terms of a constant price level, and to wring out the excess inflation that had been created by the war. Now, this was a disaster for the world economy, because, in fact, it would have been much better if we had said, we don't want to go back to the 1914 price level. If we're going to go back to gold again, we have to raise the price of gold to make the new price level the equilibrium price level. A 40% increase in the price of gold would have given us a new price level. Well, that did happen, because a year after 1933, President Roosevelt went back to the gold standard and raised the price of gold at not, it wasn't exactly the same kind of gold standard, but he raised the price of gold to $35 an ounce from $20.67, the old parity, to $35. Now you could ask why he did this. And was this a mistake or not? There was a petition circulated in the United States of 1,000 economists that said, don't do this, don't raise the price of gold. Nevertheless, he did it, and that created a new basis for the equilibrium. Now, why did people say that, and why did he raise the price? Well, there was a theory, which was the old gold standard theory, and in my view it was perfectly correct theory, that if you double the price of gold, eventually it's like a big devaluation, this will create inflation. Now, if you're students of modern international monetary economics, and you took a country that was in equilibrium, and then you had, you said, well, let's now double the price of foreign exchange. It wouldn't be gold, it would be foreign exchange. Double the price of foreign exchange from a position of equilibrium. What would that do to the price level in those countries? Well, eventually it would create a condition, balance the payment surpluses, money would come in, the money system would expand, prices and wages would rise, and the new equilibrium would be double the price level of the old equilibrium. That would be true for a small open economy. Anybody who studied the African economies, the CFA franc countries, realized that after almost 50 years of fixed exchange rates with the franc, then in 1994 they doubled the price, they doubled the exchange rate of the CFA franc, 50 francs, CFA francs for one French franc, they went to 100 francs, and this set in a set of policies that would raise the price level and double it. Well, the only thing is that the United States was not a small open economy. As I say, five times the size of any other economy at that time, and so it didn't happen quickly, but it did raise the price level. It raised the price level in some sense. So we'll go into that a little bit. Let me just plot out what the nature of my lecture is. The devaluation, that undervalued gold for a little while. There was a gold scare in 1937 when people started to sell gold to the United States because they were afraid that with the United States now buying up all this gold that the U.S. would lower the price. Academics were saying, oh, it's so silly to dig up gold in South Africa and bury it in Fort Knox. And there is a big movement to get rid of gold over that period. But that didn't happen, and then the war came, and with war came inflation. Price level rose, it more than doubled over the 1940-48 period. You don't get the inflation entirely during the war because there was price control. But immediately that price control was taken off after 1945, prices rose again. Well, then we got into the Bretton Woods arrangements, the Bretton Woods equilibrium, but now gold again became scarce because even though the U.S. had raised the price of gold, wartime inflation, post-war inflation, had made gold scarce again. And then that created problems with the way the system was working, and then all the problems of the 1960s of the gold exchange standard, the issue of monetary reform, and problems of that nature. And then eventually the dollar was taken off gold, and we had moved on to our new system of flexible exchange rates in the early 1970s, which gets me into the next lecture. Well, what I want to talk about first of all is this is a kind of continuation of the diagrammatic approach that I was using last time. Here we have the price of price level on the abscissa, and the price of gold on the ordinate. And this is the initial equilibrium, 1934, before the price of gold was raised. Well, then the price was raised to $35 from 20.67, the old parity, to $35. And that would ultimately create a new equilibrium up here. Well, what you did was to get to this point. You got to that point immediately after the devaluation, after the price of gold went up, and then it took a few years for the price level to move up in this direction. And we don't know whether it had got to equilibrium by 1914, but there was a substantial inflation in the late 1930s, but probably it might not have got all the way up here. I've just guessed at whether that was the equilibrium. But whatever is the case, with the wartime inflation, and again, the rest of the world sending gold to the United States, the U.S. was acquiring something like 70%, more than 75% of the world's stock of monetary gold by 1948. Price level went up to this point like this, and this was the where the money supplies had raised the price level to a point like this. Now, what this line does is to show that when you when you're on this side of the line, on this side, you have an excess gold. Gold is, if you like, gold is is overvalued, and over here, gold is undervalued. So the increase in the price overvalued gold, and you had a period of gold surpluses, the period of the dollar shortage. And people said that nobody in 1935 to after 35 to 1940, even to 1950, nobody cared about having gold. They were sending gold to the United States. Much better to use dollars, because there was no possibility that the U.S. would ever raise the price of gold in those periods. Dollars were much better than gold. They were liquid in the exchange markets, and this suited the monetary system better. And they also, countries could also earn interest by, if they kept their dollar balances in interest-bearing accounts. So this was excess gold. But then after the price level went up, then you got in the condition of gold scarcity again, a replay of the World War One. Now, what was the nature of the monetary system that developed in the post-war period? We had the gold standard broke down, and in World War One, it was restored. That dragged countries into the depression and the deflation of the 1930s. Gold became discredited, and economists abandoned the idea. They hated the gold standard. They became chrysophobes, using that Greek term for someone who hates gold. And they wanted anything like, they hid the idea of raising the price, they hid the idea of anything connected with gold, and they wanted to get away from the gold standard and go back to, and go on to macroeconomic, this new word, management. Macroeconomic, monetary management of the national economy. Each country would try to manage their own economy with in the best way possible. And Keynes had preached that in his book on the tract on monetary reform in 1923. And his general theory was written for a closed economy. It's principles of macroeconomic management essentially for a closed economy. Now, two things happened in 1936. There was the publication of Keynes' general theory, the principles of management, you could call it, of macro management for a closed economy. And then the tripartite agreement. France had been the holdout of the gold standard, been on the gold standard until 1936. And then had to devalue. And at that time, that was the beginning of the new system. You already got in place the post-war system, even though the war hadn't occurred yet. But you got the essence of what we think of as the post-war system in 1936. With the tripartite agreement between the United States, France, and Britain. And the essence of that agreement was that countries would notify each other of a change in policy. But already by that time, you had the basic structure of the system, because the U.S. wasn't buying or selling foreign exchange. The U.S. was intervening in the gold market, was keeping the price of gold fixed. And Britain and France were keeping their exchange rates fixed relative to the dollar. So you already had that asymmetrical system where the U.S. fixed to gold, the other countries fixed to the dollar. Well, then in 1944, in the planning for the post-war period, you had the movement the planning. The Keynes plan and the White plan. Keynes had a plan for an international clearing union. White, Harry Dexter White, the director of research at the U.S. Treasury had a plan for something else. But both plans had arrangements for a world currency. Keynes had a bancor is the world currency in his clearing union. And White, in his plan for a fund, had unitas as the world currency. Now, there's in the diaries of Lord Robbins and James Mead, that was edited by Susan Howson, there's this wonderful discussion footnote in which Lionel Robbins refers to the fact that he kept asking, bringing up the issue of what's happening to the world currency. But the world currency, by 1943, in both plans, both the American and the British plan, was slowly disappearing. And eventually it submerged, and it went away, and the Americans never wanted to talk about it. Whenever Lionel brought it up, the Americans changed the subject. The Americans had decided by that time that a world currency, if it had been created at Bretton Woods, would compete with the dollar. And it would be enough, if you have in the post-war world, to have gold and the dollar. This would be enough in the post-war system. So the world currency idea disappeared from both the Keynes plan and the plan, and you ended up with a fund that was a very much watered-down version of the other of the whole system. Now, in working out the ideas of the IMF, the ideas, the plan for it, many of the people that were at Bretton Woods didn't have a clear idea of the way the foreign exchange market worked. And they started off with this idea that each country would fix the exchange rate of every other country within 1% of its par value. Every country would have a par value defined in terms of gold or, as the unit of account, the 1944 gold dollar, as it was called. That was 1/35th of an ounce of gold, because the price of gold was $35. Every country had a par value, and how would exchange rates be fixed? Every country would keep the currency of all the other members within 1% of a par value. Now, imagine what a headache that would have been for the United States. In New York, this was already in 1944, all the currency, New York was one of the only free exchange markets in the world at that time, because this was still the wartime period, 1944. The war didn't end until 1945. So, but the New York market was open. It would have meant that the United States would have had to intervene and buy up every currency in the world in order to keep its currency fixed. The burden would have been entirely on the United States to keep the exchange rates fixed on that. So the United States quickly, at the last minute, discovered this. I guess somebody in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York must have told them this would be a disaster. And they put in a second clause in it, which said that any country, because the United States has never involved, up until this time, never involved itself in the foreign exchange market. It only fixed to gold. So they put in quickly this clause, Article 44B, which said that any country which is buying and selling gold freely, which represents to the IMF, that's buying and selling gold freely, will be deemed to be satisfying this foreign exchange requirement. So that was the beginning of the origin of this asymmetrical system that the US fixed to gold and didn't fixed to foreign exchange, and that was the enabling clause that allowed the United States to have that opt-out from the foreign exchange arrangement. Now, the United States was the only country in a position to opt-out. No other country could buy and sell gold because most of the countries had inconvertible currencies at this period. But they still had to deal with this question. Would it mean that Britain and France and every other signatory, the 44 other members of the IMF, had to keep all the currencies of the world fixed it within 1% of par value, that would have been a headache too. And the, a headache for the fund in the post-war period, that never got worked out until the later 1940s, the late after the fund got started in 1946, and then 1947, 48, around that time, it was decided that, well, you can't, any country, it was then decided by a bylaw of the fund that any country that kept a convertible currency fixed within 1% of its par value would be deemed to be satisfying the exchange requirement. So that meant that Britain, for instance, wouldn't have to fix 43 other currencies in the world, but Britain would be able to just fix the US dollar, the convertible currency, and that was the that's what made this asymmetrical system, and it was turned out to be an effective one, probably the only kind of fixed exchange system that could have worked at that time. But the IMF Articles of Agreement just groped toward it in a strange way. They groped toward, in effect, the system that had already been established in 1936 with the Tripartite Agreement. So the IMF, the Bretton Woods system, didn't create, the Bretton Woods agreements didn't create a new international monetary system. What it did was it created a new international monetary order that set the rules and groundwork by which the existing monetary system, which had been created at, by the Tripartite Agreement in 1936, could operate. And that was the system that came into being. Now, everything was working fine as long as, and over most of this period, the dollar was in a very good position, very strong position, as I said, with something like, if you want to think about gold, think about a billion ounces of gold, 1,000 million ounces of gold, what the Europeans call a milliard ounces of gold in monetary gold in the world. The United States had about 700 of that in the post-war period, the early post-war period, about 700, about 70% of that, and the other countries very little of it. But because now of the price level rising in the United States, because of the post-war inflation, and as the European countries started to get back on track again, their economies started to grow again, they started to go back to the old practice of keeping, they were buying dollars because dollars were for a while better than gold, but after a while, particularly led by the French, even as early as the 1950s, they started to convert some of their dollars into gold, and the United States started to lose gold. So that 700 million ounces that the US had out of a total of 1 billion ounces went down by 1958 to something like 600 million ounces. Still, you could say a huge amount, big, most of the world's gold stock. But then it went down to 500 million ounces, only half. And then it went down to, by about 1960, about 400 million ounces, even 350 million ounces. Now close, not much more than a third of the gold stock. And most of it was all going to the continent of Europe. With conversions of gold, and that's what created the recognition of the crisis in the world system. The crisis was that gold had become again, as it had in the 1920s, undervalued. And that's when Robert Triffin, professor of economics at Yale, wrote his book. There was an International Economics Association at Helsingør in Denmark. That's where Hamlet was said to have uttered his great oration, to be or not to be. Triffin posed then what came to be known as the Triffin Dilemma. The US was suffering a balance of payments deficit. The deficit was either the increase in dollars held abroad by Europeans, plus the loss of gold from the United States. That was the definition of the U.S. deficit. Triffin said, if the U.S. corrects the deficit, it means that Europe won't get the gold, they won't get the extra dollars, the rest of the world will be starved for liquidity. and will go into a kind of depression, deflation of the kind that we did in the 1930s. The world will run short of liquidity, there'll be a tight money, and eventually that'll lower prices and we'll get into another great deflation and depression. On the other hand, if the US doesn't correct the balance of payments problem, if they go on with this, eventually their loss of gold combined with the increase in dollar liabilities, which are claims on the gold, will put the convertibility of the dollar into jeopardy. And the US won't be able to convert anymore. And gradually, as this became apparent, as it became known, then countries, whenever they could, they would try to convert dollars into gold, because it looked as if it was going to be there was no possibility of a downside potential in gold. It was a one-way option. Gold, if it was going to do anything, it would go up in price. In the crisis was revealed very much in the election campaign of between Vice President Nixon and Senator Kennedy in the fall of 1960. And there was a possibility that a new president coming in might decide, well, gold is scarce, price level has gone down again, maybe instead of getting to get out of this dilemma, maybe the new president would double the price of gold. And there were people who had advocated an increase in the price of gold. Jack Reff had advocated that, and President de Gaulle was on his way to starting to advocate a return to the gold standard, including an increase in the price of gold. And also Sir Roy Herod in England, for different reasons, was advocating an increase in the price of gold. So it was starting to be talked about that when gold was undervalued, a solution might be to raise the price of gold. So how was gold being fixed? How was the price of gold being fixed? Well, it was fixed, the London gold market, it was fixed in London. The London gold market determined the price of gold. That was the main gold market in the world. The London gold market had been closed during the war, but the British opened it in 1954. And then, because the price was $35 an ounce, when there was an excess demand for gold in London, the British would sell gold to the market, the Bank of England would sell gold to the market, take the dollars, and then convert the dollars into gold from the United States. That was the way the system was being run. Well, in that campaign, the price of gold, the British somehow interpreted that the US Treasury might not convert the dollars into gold at $35 an ounce after the election. And so the Bank of England stopped, there was a miscommunication with the Fed, and the Bank of England stopped selling gold to the market, and the price went up to $35 an ounce in the market. And then it took a while before it got sorted out, and then candidate Kennedy made a speech in saying that he pledged to keep the price of gold at $35 an ounce, and that quieted the issue. But the crisis was still there. So, what happened then? Well, the gold came back down, but then there was a big discussion of international monetary reform, and countries began to remember what I said last night, that the international monetary system under gold wasn't operating automatically in many ways, and it was managed by the big central banks. The central banks knew of the outside, they knew that if they converted their dollars into gold, they'd bring on a crisis and that would bring down the international monetary system. Well, the international monetary system, as it was working, was much more important to Europe than it was to the United States. And they knew that if they kept converting dollars into gold and embarrassing the U.S. Treasury. And the U.S. had, Federal Reserve had a 25% reserve requirement. They had to have 25% reserves behind all Federal Reserve liabilities. The U.S. would just simply close the window, and that would break that, bring down the monetary system. So they acted with restraint, and there were all kinds of conferences going on for reform of the system and attempts to bring about a solution to the system. Now, before that happened in 1961, I came into the I have a little influence in this in some ways. I came in to work for the IMF, and I had written some papers that came to be called, some of them came to be called the Mundell-Fleming model by this time, on the monetary fiscal policy mix and things of that nature. And the IMF asked me to work on this issue of the monetary and fiscal policy mix. When Kennedy came in, there was a big, this big balance of payments deficit, what to do about it, and what to do about getting growth going, because he pledged that to get the economy, U.S. economy, growing again. And the policy, the received wisdom at that time, led by Paul Samuelson, who is a good friend of Kennedy's, and Tobin, the theoretical solution of that to get the economy growing again was the so-called neoclassical synthesis, a particular theory of the policy mix, which involved cheap money to get investment growing again. I mean, this is the Sputnik era. European economies were growing much more rapidly than the U.S. economy. It, almost the reverse of today, you see. It was a reversal. Back then, Americans were looking with envy at the European economies. They had almost zero unemployment, 2 or 3% unemployment. I think the Swiss had 6 people unemployed in the whole. Everybody in the United States was envious of how the Europeans had got to almost zero unemployment and very rapid growth and not much in the way of inflation. And so, anyway, the American solution, going along with the neoclassical synthesis, was low money, low interest rates to get investment going, and then a budget surplus to siphon off the excess inflationary aspect of that, and that would get the economy going again. So when I came to the fund, at the same time, Keynesians were pushing to get the economy going again. You had to have expansionary monetary policy and expansionary fiscal policy. The Chamber of Commerce, worried about the budget deficit and the balance of payments, was saying you need tight money and a tight fiscal policy. And this was the new classical thesis, easy monetary policy, tight fiscal policy. Keynesians, under Leon Kaiserling, the first chairman of the Federal Reserve, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, which had been created in 1946, expansionary fiscal and monetary policies, contractionary fiscal and monetary policies, and then the Samuelson-Tobin mix, cheap money and expansionary. And then I was asked to work in it, and I came out with my paper showing that the only solution was the fourth alternative here, tight money to correct the balance of payments, and expansionary fiscal policy, the tax cuts. Some of you who are study international economics may be familiar with that diagram, that budget surplus up there. And what I showed in that analysis is that you have the internal balance along the X line and the external balance along the F line, and that separates four quadrants here, characterized by unemployment and balance of payment surplus, unemployment and deficit, inflation and deficit, inflation and surplus. Well, the U.S. was in this position, and I showed first that in the first part of the paper that if you'd followed the Samuelson-Tobin policy mix, you'd move in this direction, away from equilibrium. What you had to do was to move in this direction. If you had did so that this was the direction you had to move. So that paper came out as a departmental memorandum. Now, there wasn't all that much that was original in that paper, because I had written in my Kiklos article, a more elaborate paper on the theory. And I'll tell you a little secret that David Meiselman, who is a big expert on the structure of interest rates, came over and I just met him and he asked me, well, what have you been working on? I said, I've just written this paper. And I'd said when I had been asked to work on this paper, well, I've already solved this problem in my earlier papers. And Jack Pollock said to me, well, people didn't get the message well enough. You need to do it again. So when Meiselman asked me what I was doing and I told him this, I said, he said, well, what do you think of it? And I said, well, I feel like Bizet felt when he wrote the Toreador song to Carmen. If it's trash they want, I'll give it to them. But it turned out that this was became one of my most famous papers, and I don't really tell that story very often. But it was really an approach to show, using the standard model that people were using, that this was the only way to get to solution, to the equilibrium. That was circulated as a departmental memorandum, as the IMF calls it, in November 1961. And it came out after a lot of discussion and a great deal of controversy in the IMF staff papers in March 1962. But it aroused a lot of discussion in the United States and in the US government, but there was no change in the policy mix. And meanwhile, the US economy was going deeper and deeper in the wrong direction. Inflation, there was a steel strike. Kennedy was having all these difficulties, a steel strike, there was the stock market crash, Blue Monday, as it was called, on May 19th, 1961, and the economy was getting worse and nothing was happening, there was no expansion or growth at all, and so on. So finally, by the end of the year, Kennedy gave his big speech at Yale in which he announced a reversal of the policy mix to my theory. And with the proposal for a tax cut, and the result was that this set in motion the legislative things that led to the tax cut, unfortunately, after Kennedy had been killed, but in the summer of 1964, and that led to, and helped promote that tax cut, very important, led to the great boom of the 1960s and helped to promote the great boom of the rest of the 1960s. Well, so that policy mix was a way of helping the US. But notice that what was wrong with the international monetary system in this? Well, it was that, as I mentioned, economists had moved away from the idea of thinking about an international system. And here, the mere idea that three of these policy mixes didn't consider the balance of payments worthy of consideration is an indication that Americans weren't thinking of the external system at all. In fact, it was a disequilibrium system. That was the title of an article I wrote in Kiklos in 1961, The International Disequilibrium System. Because the United States was doing nothing to promote its international equilibrium. What it was doing was sterilizing. Whenever it lost gold, that would automatically shrink the reserves of the monetary system. But immediately the Federal Reserve Bank of New York would go out and buy an equivalent amount of government bonds. So they'd replace that money and they sterilized, in other words, completely the monetary effects of that. And what that meant was that if there was going to be any kind of adjustment in the system, it was the burden of that adjustment was put entirely on the other countries. And that was the problem in the late 1960s. The inflation rate started to rise. So in the middle 60s, the system started to move into a kind of disequilibrium. And here is the way in which I put it in an article of the way the system was working and why it would ultimately crash, with a diagram in an article. This is the under the gold exchange standard. It said that the gold, European gold, their demand for gold, European gold was determining their gold conversions depending upon whether there was too much inflation or not. If there's too much inflation, they convert dollars into gold to put pressure on the United States to tighten. And meanwhile, the United States would expand monetary policy depending upon its gold reserve ratio. Whenever their gold reserve ratio would start to get really serious, then they would realize they would have to increase their, they'd have to tighten a little bit. Well, that system would, that policy mix for the world economy was going to break down because Europe was, there was a conflict system. The world economy was being too inflationary for countries led by the dollar, Germany and France, the surplus countries at that time. And there was also what Prime Minister Wilson called in the 1960s this monetary war between Europe and the United States. And it was partly conditioned very much by the animosity created by the Vietnam War, particularly among the French. And over this period, General Gaulle, advised by Jack Reff, had called for a gold standard. And there were many proposals for monetary reform over this period. There was the so-called Bellagio Committee, a Princeton Bellagio Committee that was formed by Fritz Machlup of academicians. How that committee got started was as follows. At the 1963 IMF meetings, Fritz Machlup, Professor Machlup of Johns Hopkins University then, then he'd moved to come to Princeton University, heard Secretary Dillon talk about economists. And he heard Secretary of the Treasury Dillon, Douglas Dillon, say, there's no point asking economists for their opinions because economists never agree. So Professor Machlup felt challenged by that, and he formed with Robert Triffin and William Feller this so-called Bellagio-Princeton meeting. And on it, most of the people were quite old, but two of the younger people were Peter Kennan and myself, and we attended those meetings. And anyway, that group, which brought out its report in 1964, it studied four possible alternatives. One was a return to the gold standard, as de Gaulle and Jacques Rouff and a few other people wanted. A second was create a world central bank, as Robert Triffin was pushing. A third was create a new reserve asset as a substitute for gold. If gold was scarce, create a substitute for gold that would do make it unnecessary, it would economize on gold. And the fourth solution was go for flexible exchange rates, which a few people, only a few people at that time, were really enthusiastic about. But they included Milton Friedman and James Mead, and then by that time, Habler, Gottfried Habler, and even Harry Johnson had by that time been converted to that solution. But as the only solution to be negotiated was at that time was the new reserve asset. So in 1967, the group of 10, the board that was recommended this new reserve asset, which was the SDR, special drawing rights. When you the fund IMF has this strange language, they call their reserves in a way and deposits It's like a deposit. They call them drawing rights. And then these would be special drawing rights. It was a kind of the language that people, bureaucrats, use when they don't want to call a spade because there isn't complete agreement on it. Some people, they wanted to create a reserve. Some people wanted a reserve asset. Some people wanted, countries wanted less than a reserve asset. And so they had this obscure language. And this was what was created. And it was convertible. It was had a gold weight guarantee. 1/35th of an ounce of gold. One SDR was 1/35th of an ounce of gold, and that was created in and ratified at the IMF meetings in 1967 by the governors, and then it required amendment, and it passed the government in 1968, and it provided for about $10 billion spread out over 3 years to be created in the 1970s. Well, it wasn't going to do the job. It was too little and too late, because what had happened in the meantime was that the excess demand for gold, up to this time, there was more gold being produced, so that the group of seven countries had formed a gold pool, and they would take the excess supply of gold on the market, they'd buy it, and then distributed among themselves. So each of the seven countries got a little bit of gold. But in 1967, private demand for gold exceeded private supply. And then countries didn't want to, in the gold pool, didn't want to feed some of their own scarce gold into the market. So the gold pool was disbanded. And eventually, after 1968, the private market price of gold was allowed to go above the $35 price. The Bank of England stopped feeding gold to the London market at $35 an ounce. The price went up above that amount, and that was it. Now, what do you think happened? Well, countries agreed not to intervene in the private market themselves. But what do you think happened when the price of gold in the free market went up to $35 and $40 an ounce? Nobody wanted to trade gold or get rid of gold to other central banks at $35 an ounce when it was worth $40 an ounce. So gold suddenly became immobilized. Suddenly, it was as if all the gold reserves of the world couldn't be used as reserves. They were put in the back of the burner. People would get rid of foreign exchange first, but they wouldn't use those reserves. So suddenly you had this excess tightness developing, and when you added the $10 billion of reserves by the created by the SDRs, it was not even enough to compensate for this excess tightening. So eventually in 1971, countries came to the bank came to the United States and asked for conversions. Actually, it was the Bank of England that created the crisis in August 1971. The Bank of England came and asked for something like $3 billion worth of gold. And that's when the United States said, no, we're going to close the gold window. And that was what in Asia was called the Nixon shock, because that big development in 1971, August 1971, took the United States off gold. But it also put on a surtax, it also put on price controls, and it had some tight money components too. So it was a big change in policy in the United States. So this is what the system then no longer existed. The Bretton Woods arrangements no longer existed. When the U.S. was no longer buying and selling gold for foreign central banks freely, even if they hadn't been doing it very much in reality, the other countries, well, we're not going to buy the dollar. So they let the dollar drop. There was a surplus, and the flexible exchange rates came into being. Now, by this time, at the Hague Summit in 1969, already at the Hague Summit, the European countries had decided they wanted to move in the direction of European Monetary Union. And they didn't like the idea of flexible exchange rates, because at least under the dollar, when they fixed to the dollar, that kept their own currencies fixed to one another, and they had something close to a monetary union around the dollar. Well, when the U.S. went off gold, the other countries went off the dollar, and the dollar dropped, Europe tried to create a joint float. They tried to at least keep the European currencies fixed together and to float jointly against the dollar. But they couldn't do it because it's very difficult to have a joint float unless you can decide which currency is going to be the center of that joint float. And at this point, it could have been the UK, it could have been the pound, which is the old great currency, and people thought maybe still the second most important currency in the world, could be the up-and-coming Deutsche Mark, or it could be the French franc. But the French and the British and the Germans couldn't agree on one of those currencies which would lead the float, and so it didn't work. So what they ended up doing was to go back to the dollar in December 1971. Difficulties of flexible exchange rates were so uncomfortable for them that they went back to the dollar, but they went back to a dollar that was no longer convertible into gold. So they went back from an anchored dollar standard onto a pure dollar standard, effectively. Now, it's true at that time that the U.S. did raise the price of gold. It devalued the dollar by raising the price of gold when they rearranged parities. But they raised the price at which they were neither buying or selling gold. So it was a completely fictitious price. And so that system lasted for a couple of years, and then the inflation led to its demise, and that system broke up. So that's the fate of the system. Notice that it broke down for reasons that were very similar to the reasons of the first after the First World War, that gold became undervalued. Something I didn't tell you was that in the election campaign of 1968, Richard Nixon, who eventually won the campaign, sent his friend, former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, Arthur Burns, on a secret mission to Europe to sound out Europeans about the possibility of raising the price of gold, which would have been the natural solution if there's a shortage of gold, raise the price. And he went around, Burns went around secretly, incognito in some ways, and came up with the conclusion that the Europeans would be perfectly happy with an increase in the price of gold all the way around. And there was in the IMF articles a provision for a universal reduction in the par value of all currencies. The Articles of Agreement applied for that. So when Burns came back, he told this to Nixon. He said, do it, and do it immediately after the election. That was the right time to do it, and if you get elected. as he did. But then I guess Nixon forgot about it. He said, Burns, when he's writing about it, he says Nixon forgot about it. I don't know why Burns didn't remind him, because Burns became the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. But Burns was very unhappy with the whole idea of going off gold at the Camp David meeting in 1971. And there was a sort of strange sort of thing that William Safire writes about this meeting. It's really quite amusing, this whole episode, because Burns was the only holdout for the United States going off gold. He was the one that he felt gold was very important, and it should be kept in the system. It was important to maintain the international monetary system. And Safire was placed at this meeting, at this dinner that night, deliberately placed next to Burns. And Nixon called in Safire to speak with him, and he said, you know, I think Arthur, talking about Arthur's having this view about gold, he says, you know, I think Arthur is a very fine man. Tell him I said that. So that was the way Nixon would stroke his advisors over the period. Anyway, the system broke down, and that was it. So what are the lessons from it? Well, I gave some lessons from the last one, and this is a parallel sort of lessons. The first is that the myth is that discretionary management is better than automaticity. Automaticity is best if the system is good. That's what I think is the correct answer on it. Capital movements are destructive and destabilizing. All through the period of the second phase of the 20th century, you have this view that capital movements are bad, they're destructive, they're destabilizing to the system. But that's only true if the exchange system is bad. As I've said here, there are no bad capital movements, there are only bad exchange rate systems. You never have bad capital movements between New York and California. You don't have bad capital movements between England and Scotland. You have a perfect exchange rate system. You don't have uphill or downhill movements. They go in the right direction. It's only because of uncertainty of exchange rates that you get this system. Then the third, reserve currency countries can ignore the balance of payments. The answer is that whenever they do that, eventually they get into trouble. The United States ignored the balance of payments from 1934 until 1962, and eventually it created a long-run debilitating effect on the system. And of course, the United States didn't react to the inflation that was being created in that system. And then budget deficits can create or sustain employment. Remember, in the Keynesian era at this time, people were saying there's a multiplier at work and budget deficits don't matter, we owe it to ourselves. Of course, deficits, whether deficits create employment or not, depend very much on the conditions. In the Keynesian model, in that very special model of where you are in the liquidity trap and interest rates are constant and the money supply is perfectly elastic, there's a multiplier effect of fiscal policy. That's all right. But in the world that we quickly grew up into in the 1950s and 60s, that wasn't the world at all. It was a world where deficits had to be financed by sales of bonds, by borrowing. And when we issue bonds, then you have a negative multiplier effect of that. An increase in government spending has a multiplier effect, but a sale of bonds has a negative multiplier effect, and the two cancel out, and there isn't much difference. There might be some differences created by changes in velocity, but it's a trivial difference in the system. Public debt doesn't matter. Well, the public, we owe it to ourselves. The fact is that the public debt matters a lot. As we today, we've learned that very much. Everybody European community, the European Union, has learned that. The whole post-Maastricht exercise has been the fact that public debts do matter. What two countries, if a country has a public debt, they have to have a much higher level of taxation. And then you have all the negative supply side effects from that higher level of taxation that reduces the efficiency of the economy. And then there's no fixed exchange rate. In the fixed exchange rate system, there's no adjustment mechanism. Well, we see that said over and over again. Therefore, by people who advocated flexible exchange rates, including Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman would say, you can read this quotation from many times, saying there's no adjustment mechanism under fixed exchange rates. But there is. You have the same adjustment mechanism that exists between Scotland and Wales, or Wales and England, or England and Scotland, or New York and California. Exactly, you have an increase in expenditure in one country and a decrease in expenditure in the other country. So now we will see in my lecture tomorrow the finish of this discussion of what the final lessons and what the outcome of this are, because what I argue the next time is that there's a great learning process among economists and practitioners that have led us back into a realization of lessons that were applied automatically under the rather efficient, if imperfect, international monetary system of the gold standard, but that we're now moving back into that, those similar types of systems, and that we're relearning the mechanisms that worked pretty well at those times. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Those of us who were around trying to make sense of what was going on in international monetary affairs in the 1950s and 1960s, we didn't know what the hell was going on. Now, Bob, you've taken us behind the scenes, mm-hmm. and at last we can understand. And I think the way in which you use theory to illuminate history is absolutely exemplary to all your fellow economists here. I'd just like to bring in one remark, which maybe you didn't have time to bring in, the classic remark of Governor Connolly. I think this is in about 1969, when he said to the Europeans, well, the dollar is our currency, and it's your problem. And I think the Americans had a somewhat cynical attitude until finally they found they had to do something, as you described. So I think we've got time for a couple of questions, Bob, if you'd stay there and answer them. I can't see very well. I'm blinded by the flashlights, so would somebody just get up and spout a question, please? Sorry, I can't see you, but I shall hear you if you get up and put a question.
Let me just comment that Connolly was responsible for the remark that the dollar is our currency, but your problem.
Yeah.
And he always also was responsible for saying when he talked about the exchange rate on the dollar was all we want is a fair advantage.
And I suppose in a way one can say that the ramshackle system or lack of system which you described did work up to a point. From the 1960s onwards, the American economy began to expand, the European economies continued to expand, and America provided liquidity to the world by running a balance of payments deficit. And you know, maybe it was the Vietnam War which really, I mean, do you think it was the Vietnam War which brought about the crunch, because the French particularly began to disapprove of the purposes for which America was running a deficit. In other words, instead of running a deficit out of the goodness of their hearts to finance the rest of the world, they were running a deficit in pursuit of a very questionable foreign policy in the Far East.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, the that was certainly a big issue. There's another one of the questions about it is, in retrospect, what was the right solution in the to the problem in the 1960s, given with or without the Vietnam War? And it's very tempting to say that an increase in the price of gold would have been a solution. Reff had argued that, Herod had argued for that. But when Reff wanted an increase in the price of gold and de Gaulle a return to the gold standard, and Herod also, their views were quite different on it, because Herod wanted an increase in the price of gold to increase liquidity, to solve the liquidity problem. But the French wanted an increase in the price of gold so the United States could pay off its dollar balances in gold with the profits from the gold, a doubling of the price of gold, use that to pay off dollar balances, and then absolutely prevent any further expansion or use of dollars in the system. So it was going back to a rigid gold standard. Now, if we connect that up just with the way in which politics has always worked in the system, the superpower in history has always resisted international monetary reform. But the other powers, the smaller powers, a little bit less than that, have always wanted international monetary reform so they can take away some of the advantages that the superpower gets from being the top dog in the system. You know, when Britain was the top dog in the 19th century, the Americans and the French were always pushing for international monetary reform. They wanted to go back to bimetallism, or they wanted to have a common currency unit. And the British always came and wisely said, well, they'd be observers and they'd look at the issue, but they always ended up saying no, they wouldn't cooperate with anything. But then by the 1930s, when the United States had become the big power in the system, and Britain and France were much less important, then at the World Economics Conference, France wanted to go back to fixing parities and fixing the exchange system, and Britain did too, and then it was the United States that said no. And then in 1944, the United States again said no to the world currency idea. And the United States did much to, was responsible, this really would come into the next lecture, stripped away the gold guarantee from the SDR. The gold guarantee became just a basket of currency. So that's politics very much enters into it. And again, the political configuration of countries plays a big role in the system. Well, I hope we can tie together some of these issues finally tomorrow in the summary of...
Can I just ask, what would have been wrong with floating the dollar against gold instead of having a step change in the price? When it started, gold started floating upwards in the private market. Was it then an option to let monetary gold float upwards too, and as it were, let dollar and the gold find their own level?
Well, that's what did happen. Yeah. But other countries were fixing to the dollar, and if they the other countries had continued to fix to the dollar, and the U.S. had just relinquished gold, that's what the Smithsonian system, the system was from 1971 to 73. But the problem with that system is that the other countries have the balance of payments discipline on their monetary policies, but the United States has no discipline. And then you have to trust then the center country to follow the right policy. It's a little bit like, if you can see the analogy, it's a little bit like the problem of the ERM countries in Europe in 1992. When the center country, Germany, was following a policy that was too tight for the rest of Europe, and the system broke up in part. In the same way, the United States was following a policy that was too expansionary for Europe, and the system broke up for the opposite reasons.
Yeah, and I guess the discipline the euro has, which you're going to tell us about tomorrow, is rules about limiting the fiscal deficit and control of the money supply by the central bank. And maybe if the US had adopted rules of that kind, the old system would have survived.
Right.
Anyway, we'll leave that for tomorrow, because I know you have to leave us now. Tomorrow, the lecture will move back to the old theater in the LSE. I think we should just be able all to cram in there. It may be a bit warmer there than it is here. But anyway, thank you very much, Bob, again, for a fascinating lecture. Thank you.